SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
Online news pioneer.
We didn't think we were building a website. We didn't think we were publishing on the internet. We thought we were building a dial-up service like AOL was at the time.
Vice President for Content and Chief Journalist at Smart News, Inc.
We're trying to create an environment where the information people is accessing, it's quality information.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, Rich Jarolofsky. Now here's your host, Howard Wolf.
Not only have the channels used to share news changed from print to digital, but the nature of news telling has changed as well for many in the field. In addition, the democratization of the field now allows everyone to tell stories. This has led to a world awash in information with little editorial oversight. Said another way, we have a bounty of information and a dearth of knowledge. We live in a world of information overload, and we often don't know what news to trust. Today's guest on Stanford Pathfinders is trying to make sense of this changing world, and he is well positioned to do so as a journalistic pioneer. Trained as a classical journalist, he transitioned to the world of online journalism in the 1990s. He is now involved in another transition related to content aggregation. Rich Jarolofsky is the Vice President of Content and Chief Journalist at Smart News, a content aggregator that's mission is to deliver the world's quality information to the people who need it. And based on what I see in my feeds, Smart News is doing exactly that. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So I like to start off my show the same way every time, and that is to ask your Stanford origin story. So where were you when you applied? Why did you choose Stanford? And what was your favorite memory from your days as a student at Stanford?
Well, I grew up in the area. I grew up in Northern California. And Stanford was always unreachable and unattainable. To my family, it was like the temple of education. My parents didn't graduate from college. My older brother was the first college graduate in the family. I had no realistic idea that I would be able to attend Stanford, particularly since my dad had gone bust not long before I was ready to start college. So when I was admitted to Stanford, and was admitted with a financial aid package that made it possible, my entire family was stunned. I was stunned. Years later, I asked Fred Hargadon, the dean of admissions who had admitted me, and who seemed to have total recall of every application he ever reviewed. I said once, "Fred, why did you admit me?" And Fred kind of stopped for a second and scratched his head and said, "Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time."
I love that story. Favorite memory, both the Stanford Daily Times as well as others?
Well, the Daily was my life. My degree says I graduated in political science, but in fact, I graduated with a degree in the Daily. I spent, you know, every waking hour and some unwaking hours in the Daily office. But some of my favorite memories came early in my Daily tenure, when we used to put the newspaper to bed. We used to get it ready to go to the printer, always too late, like 2 or 3 in the morning. And we'd take the pages to the printer in Menlo Park. And then we would go to the all-night bowling alley that was on El Camino. And we'd bowl for several hours. And then we'd wind up at a place called the Menlo House on El Camino in Menlo Park, where we'd have breakfast at like 4:35 in the morning. Suffice it to say that I did not make a whole lot of 8 a.m. classes.
Did you sleep?
Yes, mostly through those 8 a.m. classes.
So you and I have known each other for many, many years, decades, actually. And so I know your career, and it's been an amazing career in journalism. Share with the listeners the path of your career and your savvy in the world of journalism.
Well, it's interesting. I consider that I have one of the most eccentric resumes in American journalism because the pieces don't necessarily fit together logically, although they do to me. I started with the Wall Street Journal literally straight out of Stanford. I graduated in June of 1975. Later that month, I started at the Wall Street Journal News Bureau in Cleveland. I was in Cleveland, which was a tremendous shock to my system, being a Northern California kid. But luckily, I was only there for one winter for about a year and a half. And then I was, through a bunch of unusual circumstances, offered a transfer to Washington, D.C., which was sort of my life's ambition. And I got to D.C. in the 70s and stayed in D.C. for 18 years. I was at various times the White House correspondent for the Journal. I was national political editor. I had a great run in D.C. And then in the mid-90s, because I was a little bit technologically adept, or at least I wasn't a technophobe, I got offered out of the blue the opportunity to join a very small team whose mandate was, quote, figure out what an online Wall Street Journal would be and then build it.
So this is more than 20 years ago.
This is this would have been about 1994.
Wow.
It was so early in the evolution of the online medium that literally for the first year I worked on this project, we didn't think we were building a website. We didn't think we were publishing on the internet. We thought we were building a dial-up service like AOL was at the time. And it was only after we spent a fair amount of time investigating that model that we decided, no, this new thing over here called the internet was actually going to be the way of the future. And so we took the entire project, convinced our superiors at Dow Jones, the journal's owner, that the web was the way to go, and moved the entire project online in the mid-90s. And so we launched WSJ.com in the prototype in 1995, the full thing in 1996. And I ran that for the next 7 years. And as I told people many times, it was the most fun that I'd had in journalism since I was editor of the Stanford Daily.
You were at the forefront of the internet interaction with the world of journalism. That's really quite something. So talk to us about journalism today, the state of journalism today, the challenges and the opportunities, because this is an industry that has been just turned upside down by technology.
Absolutely. And, the changes that I've seen over the course of my career, I literally began as a reporter writing stories on carbonized paper on a manual typewriter. And to see how far the medium has come in the last 40 years has just been staggering. But one of the big changes that I've seen, which I saw starting in those early days at WSJ.com and accelerating, I saw this when I joined Bloomberg, where I was for about 9 years, and into the present day, is that the center didn't hold. The idea of a mass audience of people of different political perspectives all getting their basic knowledge and their basic understanding of the world from common sources, that has fragmented. And that has had some very profound effects on not only on journalism, but really, as we see every day, on society. That idea that, well, everyone's entitled to their own views, but they aren't entitled to their own facts, that view has fallen out of fashion, I think, not only with journalism, but in American society.
So that's a perfect segue to the world that you now occupy. So you were at Wall Street Journal, then you were at Bloomberg, and now for the past, what, 6+ years?
7.5, actually.
7.5. Thank you for correcting me. You are at what is called Smart News. So what is Smart News? What's the origin story behind Smart News? Why did you join Smart News? What's your role? Tell us about Smart News.
Well, Smart News is a news aggregation app for iOS and Android. It's free.
What does that mean, an aggregation app?
In other words, we have news from not just one source like the New York Times or CBS. We have news from thousands of sources. And we take in news from the internet, from our partners. We have hundreds and hundreds of publisher partners. We take that content in, we analyze it, we classify it, figure out which stories are the most important stories. We figure out which stories are going to be of specific interest to specific users. And then we bring all that content together in one place on your smartphone. Smart News actually is Japanese owned. It was created by a couple of very bright engineers in Tokyo about 9-10 years ago. And we brought it to the US, or wanted to bring it to the US right after I had left Bloomberg. And so I was the first American hire. The company at the time was, I think I was employee number 14 worldwide. And the other 13 were all Japanese. And so I was the first US hire. And the idea, even when the company was this tiny company working only in Japan and only in Japanese language, our founders, Ken Suzuki and Kaisei Hamamoto, had a vision of this being a global company. And that this model of combining technology with news intelligence, if you will, was a powerful model that would work in any culture. And they targeted the US as, in some ways, the toughest nut to crack.
So what does that mean, news intelligence? What does that mean?
Well, it's interesting. One of my titles, I am vice president for content at Smart News, but I have a secondary title, which is chief journalist, which when I first heard that suggested, I said, you know, in the US, the title would probably translate more into editor in chief. And Ken and Kaisei said, if you want to be the editor in chief, that's fine. But the reason we chose chief journalist is because if you call yourself the editor in chief, it implies that you're editing the content, that you're making decisions about what it is that people will see. In our case, it is the technology that is actually making the decisions on individual pieces of content in most cases, but it's human beings that have to have the intelligence to tell the algorithms, this is important, this is high quality, this is not important, this is low quality. So in a lot of ways, I and the crew at Smart News view our jobs not just as saying this is an important story, it should go to everybody, which we do on big breaking news, but also working with the engineers to try to shape the algorithms to make the algorithms journalistically more intelligent.
So this is interesting because in a world where there's a democratization of information, right? You don't know, no one has to worry about being edited. You can just create content out there and put it out into the world. Your app, through its business intelligence or journalistic intelligence, is able to discern what's really worthy of people's attention.
That's the goal. And no technology is perfect, but technology makes that attainable. It makes it scalable. I can't make a decision on 5,000 stories a day. Is this worth showing? Is this not worth showing? But I can work with our engineers to help establish the rules that the algorithm will apply to say, is this worth knowing? Is this not worth knowing? Not all information is created equal. And in fact, as we've seen time and time again in recent years, bad information, just like bad money in Gresham's law, bad information devalues good information. And so we're trying to create an environment where the information people is accessing, it's quality information. And that means that we have to be able to make decisions or use technology to make decisions, not just to show everything to everybody, but to say this information is worth more than that information, and thus it should be weighted more heavily.
And it seems to be working. And I know you're the chief journalist and the chief content officer, but I'm going to ask you a business question. It seems to be working because the last round of financing valued the company at $2 billion. So what is the business model? Is it an advertising model? What is it a subscription? How does it work?
Right now, it's an advertising model. We have relationships with many, many publishers. We're able to monetize their content in ways that maybe they can't. We can introduce people to new audiences and introduce their content to people who might otherwise not see that content. So that is one of the things that fuels our advertising model. Now, there are other models and other areas of interest. At the Wall Street Journal back in the 90s, when we launched, one of the things that distinguished us at the time we launched is we were the first publication, the first major news publication to charge a subscription fee. And we were told for years we were idiots doing that. But I think time has proven that there is also a viable subscription-based content ecosystem out there. So while we're advertising-based now, and I and God bless our advertisers, there is also a world of high-quality content that may not be advertising-based in the future.
And so who are competitors?
When we first launched, there were other standalone news apps with names like Zeit and Circa and Pulse, and we were directly competing with them. Most of those apps are gone. And then for a while, it was social media was our major competitor, particularly Facebook. But in the wake of the Trump election, Facebook did some pulling back from news. Now I feel like Facebook is certainly a competitor. But if you're an iPhone user, you have Apple News preloaded on your device. If you're a Google user, you might have Google News. So we, in that regard, we're swimming among sharks, huge predatory companies. But I actually think that's a competitive advantage for us because increasingly, I think audiences are kind of skeptical of big tech. They're really wondering when they see something in their Facebook feed. They're wondering, why am I seeing this? What's in it for Facebook? And this suspicion of large tech platforms determining what it is you see, I think leads a growing number of people to want to have an independent source of news and information that also allows them to sample content, maybe even from of different political persuasions than they otherwise would see.
But isn't it a world where even for you, you're not big tech, you're little tech, but the more salacious the title, the more negative the article, the more people tend to gravitate towards those. And so don't you find yourself somehow being pulled into that sphere?
Well, what we've discovered is that kind of content may give users a sugar rush, like a quick fix of endorphins. But over time, it doesn't build loyalty. People have a sense they're missing something when all they're getting is clickbait and stories that conform to their own preconceived notions. It gets boring over time. And boring is really the enemy. So, for example, at Smart News, we launched a feature a couple of years ago that we call News from All Sides. And it is a feature that appears on many of our political stories that allows the user to scroll back and forth to see how more liberal news outlets might be covering this story and to see how more conservative outlets might be covering this story. It gives people a sense, and it gives them not only control over what they're seeing, but the ability to sample a wide range of views. I sometimes refer to Smart News as sort of, in political terms, as sort of a safe space. Because if you're a liberal, you're unlikely to install, let's face it, you're highly unlikely to install the Fox News app on your phone. If you're a conservative, you're highly unlikely to install Mother Jones app on your phone. And yet you might want to sample that content without immersing yourself in it to see what people whose political persuasions are very different than yours are saying to each other.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because when I used to go to the gym, of course, I don't do that anymore because of the pandemic. I used to enjoy kind of flipping back and forth between the different TVs when I was on the treadmill. So I'd watch CNBC and then I'd watch Fox and then I'd watch CNN and then I'd watch something else. And boy, you thought you were in a different world when you're watching that. But yours sounds like, in many ways, a digital version of that wonderful weekly magazine called The Week, right? Where it shows it talks about a topic and then it brings different views from different perspectives into play, but it's ink on paper, it's analog, right? It's old fashioned.
The Week is one of our partners. They exist digitally as well. But yes, you're right, conceptually, there are certain similarities, but we love The Week. It's one of my favorite sources within Smart News.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More with Smart News executive Rich Jarolowski about finding news you can trust in a world of information overload. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with Rich Jarolowski, Vice President of Content and Chief Journalist at Smart News, about finding news you can trust in a world of information overload.
You're a journalist, and I know that the title says Chief Journalist, but was it a big jump for you to go to an aggregator? Because you're no longer doing journalism yourself, but you're aggregating the journalism done by others. Is that satisfying? Is that different? Have you come to love that? Talk to us about that sort of pivot in your career and why that made sense.
Well, it's interesting because even now I get asked this question fairly frequently, like, what prompted you 7.5 years ago to come to Smart News? And there were a couple of reasons. One is I was immediately taken with Ken and Kaise, the co-founders, who, although not journalists, they're engineers, instinctively understood the importance of journalism. So that was part of it. But the other part of it was that there were other jobs I could have taken at that time. They were perfectly good jobs. I would have done a good job in any of them. I would have been very happy doing those jobs. But in every one of those other jobs, I knew everything that I would need to know the day I would have walked in the door the first time. In other words, I know how to edit a newspaper. I know how to set up a digital newsroom. I know all these things because I've done them before in my career. Smart News was the one job opportunity that I had where I knew that I'd have to learn new stuff, where I knew that I didn't know it all coming in, and it would be an education. And, you know, when you get to my advanced stage in your career and you can say, you're still learning new stuff, as far as I'm concerned, you win. And I learn new stuff every day, even now.
So I saved one of my easiest questions for the end. And that is just a simple, very direct question. What's the future of journalism in America?
There's never been a time that journalism is more important because there's never been a greater need for quality journalism. There's never been a greater need for people to understand each other. The divisions within society are so profound. The lack of empathy, the lack of understanding across political boundaries is so great that we really need journalism to be able to step in and to say, you know, in some ways, it isn't so much to referee the debate, but maybe at least to reframe the debate that's going on, to provide that common base of knowledge so that you don't just have one echo chamber over here and one echo chamber over there, and all you're hearing is the same stuff. I think journalism made a mistake to a certain extent as the audience is fragmented. I think a lot of journalistic outlets basically doubled down on appealing only to the people who agreed with their point of view and not in reaching across to try to convince people who didn't necessarily agree. And I think that that's what's really required, is some sort of glue, if you will, that journalism can provide that brings together these two conflicting viewpoints and at least gives them a common forum and a common frame of reference.
All right. So in the minute that we have left with each other, I want to appeal to you to give your years of experience and share with our listeners, in particular, our current Stanford students or students anywhere in higher education who are thinking, I always wanted to be a journalist. What would you say to those young people today?
Well, in a lot of ways, journalism is a lot more complicated now than it was when I was starting out. I used to say when I was starting out about the only skills that I needed beyond the ability to report accurately and write semi-coherently was that I needed the ability to type. And to this day, I'm still a very good typist. It's much more complicated today in the sense that there are many more tools and many more skills that you need, and you need to be comfortable in all of them, whether it's reporting and writing in a traditional sense, whether it's working in multimedia, you need to have those skills. But the fundamental thing that you absolutely need to have is the fire in the belly, the need and the desire to inform your fellow citizens about what's going on in the world. And if you have that fire in the belly, all those tools and all those skills that you need don't become burdens, they become opportunities, because the tools to tell stories have never been more powerful.
And Rich, over the years, you've told some great stories as a journalist, and we thank you for doing that. Thank you so much for being on the show. I thoroughly enjoyed our time together, and I think our listeners will as well.
Thank you so much, Howard.
Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM. Listen to this and other episodes anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app or wherever you'd like to find your podcasts.